Early this year, Jordan Taylor Hill traveled to Senegal and Guinea to expand his musical training. It wasn't the first time his passion for drumming took him to West Africa.
I went there actually as an undergrad. I had asked for an internship to study dance and drumming.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear Jordan's story. We'll also hear about a foreign student trying to navigate dating in the U.S. and spend an academic minute searching for long-lost languages. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Jordan Taylor Hill is no stranger to traveling as a student. He traveled to Senegal to study drumming and dance about 8 years ago, and he returned to Africa earlier this year to expand his artistic background. From the podcast Postcards from the Road, Elizabeth Hill, no relation, has his story.
In early 2019, Jordan Taylor Hill traveled to Senegal and Guinea to expand his musical background as an artist. Hill says his passion for drumming and his previous visits to West Africa sparked his trip back.
Yeah, I went to West Africa to study the music and dance, djembe mostly, and the dance with an artist from Le National Ballet, Mustapha Bangora, and his dance company, Le Bagatay, in Conakry. So I was in Senegal for 2 weeks before that, kind of with a group, you know, just seeing the country, even though I had been there before. After the 2 weeks, I had went on my own to Guinea to do the training intensive, dancing for like 4 hours a day and drumming 2 hours a day.
And what inspired you to do this?
I just love it. I mean, my first time, so I had been to Senegal before. I went there actually as an undergrad, you know, in 2011. And had asked for my internship, and it was only 3 weeks, but I had asked for an internship to study dance and drumming because I'd always like seen a djembe growing up, but I'd never really been exposed to it. So I was just curious about it. So when I went to Senegal, I got to watch some dance troupes practice and then watch another company practice. And I was watching them do more traditional Senegalese style music, which is sabar. And they play that with a stick and it's like really high pitched and it's kind of loud actually at times. But that's how they would communicate like across villages and things like that, you know, playing certain rhythms for certain events or festivities or things that are happening. So people can hear the music and understand what's happening. So we went from one dance troupe, which was doing sabar with a man, Edie Faye, and the dance company was Conte Diouf, which is just means with fish. And then from there, we went to Blaise Senghor, the cultural center, and we're just watching people dance and drum djembe. It blew my mind. Just blew my mind. It was like one of those things where it felt like it was like magic. Hearing this amazing music and seeing people do all of this movement that was put together so well, it was just, how is this even happening all at once? I hear what I hear and how they hear that, you know, and are able to like dance to it in this manner that it was like incredible, you know. So I had bought a little djembe drum and was walking around like all of Senegal with it, you know, and people were like, oh, djembe fola, djembe fola. So fola means like player, right? So djembe is the drum and then fola is a Malinke word for player. So there's other instruments, you know, like kora, so, and that's a string instrument, and they might call you a kora fola or balafone fola. And I was like, yeah. And people would just be like, oh, can you play it? And I'd just like start banging on the drum, you know. And I'm just like thinking about it now, like, dang, if I knew what I know now then, you know. They were very warm about it, though. You know, they could tell, obviously, that I had, like, was just very excited to have the drum and stuff like that and wanted to learn as much. So, yeah, that's kind of how I first got introduced to it and exposed to it. And from there, you know, I went back to SUNY Albany, and we had just started drumming on campus there. We're doing, like, community work. You know, I was very, like, Afrocentric, for lack of a better word. I just always wanted to learn, the drum. And people could, I guess, pick up on that. And, you know, I just try to pick up pieces here and there, watch YouTube videos and stuff like that. Fast forward 7.5, 8 years later, you know, I'm still playing it and even teaching to some people as well and just sharing my experiences. So just really grateful for that. So, yeah, that's what brought me there.
What was Senegal like?
Amazing. Senegal is beautiful. I don't really speak that much French. So at times it would be a little difficult, but Senegal is like was the French West capital of Africa. It really is a great example of democracy. And yeah, I mean, the people there are just very warm. You know, I say that about democracy, but the first time I was there, the president at the time, he was trying to run for a third term, basically. And he tried to change an amendment and say that his first term wasn't legitimate. So people were like protesting and things like that. And like, it was just this crazy thing. And I have no idea what's happening, you know, but people are like burning tires and things like that. And they're speaking in French and Wolof. And I'm like, what's happening? And, you know, the power goes out and stuff. I'm with a group from three universities. So it wasn't ever at a point where it's like my life was in danger, you know, because as a student, you had to register and like let the U.S. government know that you're actually going to be there and stuff. Yeah, that happened. But overall, Senegal is just an amazing place. And I could totally see myself living there at some point in my life. You know, yeah, I just got to brush up on my French.
What was the highlight of being in Senegal?
Probably revisiting places and people that I'd seen before. Like I said, Blaise Senghor is a cultural center that I had been to as an undergrad. After that, in 2011, I went back there 2016, and I was like living there for like 3 months. So I kind of developed my own routine and like friends and stuff like that. So after leaving and coming back, I came back for a conference a year later. And then this past December, going there, you know, knowing some villages, knowing how to get there, knowing how to get to like Toubacouta, which is just north of the Gambia, you know, or knowing about Blaise Senghor, the cultural center, and just meeting people, artists there that remembered me, that I remembered, that also know people in the States that are like, they move stateside, you know, and they're like teaching classes and things like that. That was really amazing. And going to St. Louis, which was the first, that was actually the first capital of Senegal. And it's like just north of Dakar. And the architecture there, it's beautiful. I was with a group. I figured it was a great opportunity for me to get from one country to another and kind of escape the cold that happens in New York.
So you go from Senegal to Guinea. What was it like to study African drumming in Guinea for 4 weeks?
It was intense. It was very humbling. Yeah, I say like I first picked up the drum summer 2011, so almost 8 years ago. And I knew I had a lot to learn and still have a lot to learn. But seeing the people there and seeing how natural the drumming comes to them, the dance comes to them, you know, being able to recall certain rhythms, certain steps so quickly and like the little nuances, like, no, the break's not bri-bri-bri-bri, it's bri-bri-bri-bri. You're like, wait, what's the difference? Is that okay, so it's a tone, not a slap, or like you have to put an accent here or there and stuff like that. That was like, wow, there's so much to learn, you know, still, which is, it's kind of liberating too, because it's a practice. And with a practice, it's something that you continue to do. You might achieve a level of like mastery, people might say, right? But even when you're there, you're still learning stuff. You're still learning about your body. You're still learning about music. You're still learning from other people. Yeah, that was something that was really good for me. You know, I would learn about like kuku, which is a dance to inspire and encourage the fishermen when they would go out to fish. You know, they'd be on their boat and people would be drumming on land, you know, and then there'd be people dancing and stuff like that, you know, and like some of the steps resemble the fishermen and, you know, the dun dun or the sangban, the way it's played there is different from what I've learned here. Like I would learn something straight, like, but they would play it like, so it's just like those little nuances, you know, that they're like, oh, okay, learning those parts was really good. I just try to practice it now, and like I recorded a lot too, so I like just try to practice it when I'm at home and stuff, and like use it or lose it. So.
Yeah.
Still to come, we'll hear the rest of Elizabeth Hill's feature on drummer Jordan Taylor Hill. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and we're listening to Elizabeth Hill's feature on drummer and dancer Jordan Taylor Hill and how he got his training in West Africa from her podcast, Postcards from the Road. We pick up the story with Jordan talking about the highlight of his trip to Guinea.
It's probably seeing a dundumba, and a dundumba is a set of rhythms that come from one region, mostly Karusa, in like Northeast Guinea, close to Mali. But dundumba is like a celebration, or it's a dance for the strong man. Like, not just men, but like, they use man as like interchangeably man and woman.
Gotcha.
You know, when they have a dundumba, it might be for like a wedding. The one I was at was for a wedding. You know, I've always would watch all these YouTube videos or just listen to the music where people from this one area will come together, or artists will come to this one place because of this celebration. And the drummers will be there and they'll play the music an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, however long. And they start off in a circle, you know, and they'll go around in the circle and they'll do a few steps. And then after they clear out the circle, people will go in individually and do like dance solos. It was just really awesome to see in person, you know, because I don't know, that's a big part of their culture. I think it's similar to like a cipher in like the hip hop world. Yeah, you kind of get to freely express yourself, drummers and dancers, young and old. You know, it'll start off with the kids. Like the kids will just be messing around, playing tag, doing steps and stuff like that. And then like the younger folks will come, and then sometimes even older adults will go in too. But yeah, just getting to see that documented and being with people that were just really well-trained, probably some of the best artists in Guinea, seeing them like do their own thing in that element. Yeah, it's just amazing to be like, wow, I'm actually here watching this right now.
I've seen some of your videos. Could you describe maybe what is so unique about the dancing in Guinea?
Well, you use a lot of your body, first of all. So like, you know, ballet, they might go like this. And it's like very isolated movements. But like with djembe music, with people in Guinea, you know, you're like, gong, 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 gong. You know, that's a big part of it. And it's just a feeling. The djembe And that culture comes from there, you know, and it's like such a widespread thing now. It comes from like Malinke, Mandinka people for the most part, you know, its origins, like Northeast Guinea, the Mali Empire. And when you go there, there's people from different ethnicities, you know, Susu, Baga, Fulani, Malinke, but you see how they still sort of come together and represent Guinea as a country and like represent that music. I don't know, when you see it, it's just like, this is crazy. You know, you've probably seen it too, because I know you've been to some like Latin American countries, right?
Yeah, Belize and Guatemala.
Yeah, and even you're going to Cuba.
Yeah, I'm going to Cuba in June.
Not to timestamp this.
Yeah, right.
But you'll see it there too, like that call and response, the conversation between the drums and the dancing, you know.
Yeah.
You can't have one without the other. And yeah, people, I think, just they internalize that and like carry it with them.
Yeah, there's almost like a freedom to the way that the dancing comes across, especially in your videos.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it just, you know, the music takes them.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. It made me feel like I was like a lot better at dancing than I am, you know. I'm like, let me slow down a little bit right now. No, but I do think it was really helpful for me too, just being able to study with the people that were so great, and they were just very patient with me too, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of the time I was able to train with people individually, have two people trying to break down steps. For me, you know, it's just about sharing that information and experience with people now.
So you have a visa. You can go back at any point in the next 3 years.
Yes.
But will you expand and go to other areas in Africa and really see some diversity?
I would love to. Absolutely. Yeah, if anybody wants to pay me to do that, I'll definitely go do it. No, I was actually just looking at some grants and things like that, you know. There's some opportunities to study in like sub-Saharan Africa. My interest, I think, right now is mostly West Africa.
Yeah.
It would be really great to go to Nigeria. It'd be really great to go to Ghana, Gambia, Sierra Leone. Those four countries speak English, which would be nice.
Yeah.
But also there's this like wave of Afrobeat, and it's like dance music with African melodies and singing. Even some Latin American, like in Guatemala, they play the marimba,
yep.
You know, and you'll hear that a lot. But yeah, I think everyone should go, be open-minded, you know, especially African Americans, Black Americans in the West. You know, I think there's a lot for you there, for us there, maybe to see that there's more to our story than what is often told, which I think a lot of times starts with slavery. There were empires and kingdoms and people thriving in civilizations long before Arabs came, long before Europeans came. And when you can connect with that and understand that and change the narrative that I was even told and internalized a bit, you know, I had no idea that there was this beautiful culture and group of people that were there, and being open to building with people there, you know, I think that's a really important thing, not just going there as like a tourist, or not just going there and saying like, oh, I'm going to do my volunteer work. What do they call it? It's like this term now, voluntourism, you know, where
voluntourism.
We think we're like going to this place and giving people, and I've been guilty of it too, to some degree, you know, we have these ideas of what people need, right?
Yeah.
Anywhere, not just Africa, but in these quote-unquote developing countries, and kind of impose our ideas on them. But that may not be culturally relevant to them and what they need, you know.
Yeah.
I know it's a lot better to think about them, not just as people, but where you can conduct business, you know, and commerce and trade experiences and share and things like that. So, yeah, that's definitely something that I try to carry with me, even here, too.
Audio from this episode was provided by Jordan Taylor Hill. To learn more about Hill's journey, upcoming drum workshops, and his music, visit jordantaylorhill.com.
And you can hear Elizabeth Hill's full feature on Jordan Taylor Hill on her podcast, Postcards from the Road, which is available along with other WAMC and National Productions podcasts, including The Best of Our Knowledge, at wamc.org/podcasts. Immigrants in the U.S. can often find themselves straddling two or more cultures. That's the case for Ying Si Chin, a first-generation Chinese immigrant and sophomore at Bodine High School in Philadelphia. She has one foot planted in the culture she sees in the U.S. and the other in the lessons her parents teach her. She filed this report for Philly Youth Radio.
I love watching Chinese soap operas at home. But when a love scene comes up, if my mom's around, I can't watch in peace. She starts yelling and tells me I shouldn't do what the characters on TV are doing. I tell her she shouldn't worry because I'm not even interested in dating. But when I asked to interview her to see why she felt that way, she got upset and didn't want to talk about it. So I asked my friend, who I'll call Jane, about her mom.
When my mom walked on the street, she always saw a lot of young people holding hands and kissing. And then when she comes home, she will tell me, no, you can't date. Don't date at young age. Don't let me see you holding hands with another guy.
Most of my Chinese immigrant friends have the same experience. Their parents told them not to date and to focus more on education.
My mom got married at a very young age. He was like introduced by a person, and then she married my father. And she always said to me that if she didn't marry my father, she will have a lot of opportunity to get a good job, a good education, and probably a better guy.
When I talk to other Chinese immigrant teens, I notice most of their parents were formally introduced to their partners. In their world, there's no such thing as dating. And that's the problem for me. In the U.S., we're expected to date, while our parents want us to follow the old rules. This can cause problems, especially when kids date without their parents' permission. Like Jane. In seventh grade, she spent all her time with a boyfriend and hid it from her parents.
And then there's one time I lied to my mom that I'm doing schoolwork in school, and actually I'm just out there like sitting in the park with him. And then my mom told me that she was waiting at the bus stop, bending there with my brother. And it was in the winter, and I felt very ashamed about that.
Since then, Jane has decided to take a break from dating, but she still struggles with liking guys.
And I'm always tell myself that I'm not really liking that person. I'm just having some feeling about them. And after a while, that feeling would disappear, and then I will become normal again, and then another feeling, and then disappear again, and then another one, and continuously.
But enough from the kids. Let's see what dating means to parents.
Can you introduce yourself?
Pang Tai.
Mrs. Pang was born in Hong Kong. She met Mr. Pang through his sister.
Enjoy dating.
Mrs. Pang says that in her culture, dating was forbidden. And when a girl got married, if she wasn't a virgin, her husband could just divorce her. Mrs. Pang says that's why Chinese immigrant parents are so against their kids dating.
I'm Crystal Pang, the daughter of Fan, who you just interviewed.
Crystal remembers that she was taught not to date when she was young, but she dated anyway in her senior year of high school. And she's been with the same guy for 7 years. They even have their parents' support now. And as Crystal has reached her mid-20s, she's noticed that Chinese immigrant parents eventually encourage relationships in their own strange way.
I actually have a few friends who are going through that right now. Their parents are sometimes suggesting people that they've never met before that are from California when the person lives here. The mom even went so far as to show my friend a video of this guy giving a PowerPoint presentation.
Here's what I think. Parents have good intentions for banning dating, but it's too much control over kids' freedom. Children's decisions may be wrong, but parents should be beside them, helping them. And who knows? Maybe one can find true love at a young age, like Crystal has.
That story produced by Yancy Chin from Philly Youth Radio.
妙針忽然停頓過.
The search is on for languages that no one speaks anymore. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Extinct languages can be brought back from the dead. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Erilyn Hansen, assistant professor of modern languages and cultures, explores this process in Central America.
According to UNESCO, approximately 600 languages have disappeared in the last century, with one dying every 2 weeks. The indigenous language of Brunca, from present-day Boruca in Costa Rica, lost its last native speaker this past April. However, in 2010, linguists had already declared Brunca to be extinct, basing their assessment on the number of living fluent speakers. Although research from 2 decades ago shows Brunca losing ground, through recent field research, I've documented continuing efforts to bring back the language. While it is true that the majority of the elders who speak Brunca have passed, some of the next generation are invested in bringing back the language. Doña Celedina Maroto, the granddaughter of the documenter and linguist Espiritu Santo Maroto, lives in neighboring Corray. When asked if she speaks Brunca, Maroto rattled off a few phrases proudly, saying that her children, all adults now, also speak Brunca. Although now retired, Maroto taught Brunca for years in the schools and is still working to bring the language back through community workshops, two of which occurred this past October and were well attended. Leila Garro Valverde has offered traditional Brunca cooking classes and written and published a cookbook with Brunca recipes, which has received little recognition. She remarked that if she did not do this vital work, others may not, and then the information and language would be lost. Garro Valverde has also brought together younger Brunca people to create an interactive map with place names in Brunca and GPS coordinates to make the places discoverable by later generations. These are just 2 examples of how the community is bringing Brunca back. These efforts contribute to the growing and diverse field of language revitalization.
And that was Erilyn Hansen of Arcadia University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.